This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Coming up, Fiji police are taking the extraordinary step to burn the tons of drugs kept on site as evidence. But some say it might not be getting to the heart of Fiji's drug problem.
People are desperate. This is why they're trying to figure out a way to make a quick buck, to relieve some of this stress.
Pacific leaders scrutinise Solomon Islands' decision to suspend foreign Navy ship arrivals.
You keep on pushing away a friendly ally. You know, it's times of need. They might not be there for you.
And we look at how a deadly shooting on a ship in Papua New Guinea has prompted fears over border tensions. First, Pacific businesses are worried about an exodus of workers taking up jobs in Australia as part of the government's labour mobility program. They are urging for reform, saying the scheme is hurting their bottom line and pushing Pacific industries to crisis point. Dubrovka Volodar with this report.
Restaurant owner Sangeeta Maharaj has worked hard over the past decade to train her staff at the upscale Eden Bistro in Fiji's capital. But all of a sudden, she's lost many workers.
With the scheme of taking workers from here to Australia, it is so sudden and it is so extensive that it's like an exodus. We've had no front of house staff a month ago.
She's lost four chefs and the majority of her 21 waiting staff in recent months.
I got resignations on Thursday and they stopped coming from Saturday. So with 1.5 days of notice.
She says training local staff from scratch on short notice is difficult and has recently hired chefs from Asia to fill the gaps. Shakil Zorobamji has had a similar experience. He owns Coffee Hub, a popular cafe chain in Fiji.
It is quite difficult as we are pretty much standing on one leg at the moment due to shortage of staff.
He opened the chain during the pandemic and employed about 95 staff, but has lost about 20 this year.
The more we recruit and then the more experience the staffs gain, then that's just how the turnover is. They get other approached by the hotels because the hotels continuously lose staff for this work scheme, or they just leave to go and work overseas.
With no other option, he's had to reduce his opening hours.
I've had staff resigning instantly because they would just get their visas just like that and they would literally just abandon the workplace and leave. So that has been really, really frustrating.
For businesses around the Pacific, this staffing crisis couldn't come at a worse time. The industry is struggling to rebuild after 2 years of closed borders during the pandemic. As workers move abroad, there are concerns for the Pacific economies to be left behind, which rely heavily on tourism and hospitality. The Fiji Hotel and Tourism Association's Fantasia Lockington says the situation was manageable when borders first opened, but things are now at crisis point.
It's now 9 months on and we're experiencing a very positive high season, but one that also coincides with both Australia and now New Zealand opening up fully and also requiring workers. We understand it's going to happen. It's just happened at a level that we've never seen before.
But for the workers heading to Australia, the decision was easy. 28-year-old Fijian chef, who we are calling Lisa, is moving to Queensland in early September to work in a hotel on a six-month visa. She didn't want to use her real name as she was worried she could lose her job.
I've been in the cafe for 2 years. Finally got an opportunity to move out and work in Australia, so I'm just preparing myself for that. Mostly it's like, how am I going to experience like my chef life in Australia compared to Fiji?
The Australian Department of Employment and Workplace Relations says at the end of July this year, there were more than 26,000 palm workers in Australia. A pool of about 52,000 Pacific workers are approved to take up jobs in Australia. Officials in Samoa and Vanuatu have told the ABC an exodus of workers is biting their industries. But for businesses in Australia welcoming the workers, their support is important. Matt Lang is Chief Operating Officer at Good Day Group, which runs Kings Canyon Resort in the Northern Territory. They recently hired 24 Vanuatu workers.
Without the farm workers, we couldn't support the increased demand and capacity and get a great wage. We give them quality training and an experience and improve their job prospects.
A spokesperson for the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs says the PALM scheme supports Pacific workers to develop new skills or upskill.
PALM scheme partner countries have their own labour mobility policies and control who can register in their work-ready pool. The Australian government respects partner country decisions on where they focus their efforts on labour mobility.
Fantasia Lockington from Fiji's Hotel and Tourism Association says the Australian government should chip in more to help train local staff.
What we'd like to see is a little bit more discussion about how they can support a little bit more training rather than simply making it easier for them to go across.
But for those back in the Pacific, like cafe owner Mr. Bumji, he needs those skilled workers now.
Most of my staff have zero experience, so we just literally training them on our product knowledge. I feel like now we live in a world where our customers are more informed than our staffs.
Shakil Zora Bamji there with Dubrovka Volodare reporting, and the ABC has contacted the Fiji government for comment. We're still awaiting a response. The Papua New Guinea government has launched an investigation into the fatal shooting of an Indonesian fishing boat captain. PNG Foreign Minister Justin Chichenko says he hopes that inquiry will determine the exact circumstances surrounding the incident.
There's a lot of stories going out there of what happened. And I would say over the next couple of days we'll have the truth of the matter exposed and reported about.
Minister Chichenko says he is working with the Indonesian embassy to get to the bottom of the shooting. Indonesia, meanwhile, has responded with a diplomatic protest over not just this death, but also the detention of more than a dozen Indonesian fishermen in Papua New Guinea. Minister Chichenko says PNG takes illegal fishing seriously and more investigation into these cases is needed.
Illegal fishing is a major, major problem in Papua New Guinea. And these two illegal Indonesian boats were apprehended in PNG waters. And I believe now those people are now in custody here in Port Moresby. They were on those boats.
Meanwhile, this week, Penny Wong became the first Australian government minister to visit PNG since Prime Minister James Marape was re-elected. While there, Minister Wong said her government was working with the Pacific to curb illegal fishing.
We understand, leaving aside the detail of this incident, this is a really big issue for PNG, it's a really big issue for the region, it's a really important issue for both economic sovereignty but also food security.
Australia National University maritime law expert Professor Donald Rothwell says the incidents could become a flashpoint for relations between PNG and Indonesia.
Quite often, the killing of fishermen under these types of circumstances can lead to a rise in tensions between neighbouring countries. And there's many examples of that throughout Southeast Asia where that type of incident creates those sort of tensions. There's also not a lot of experience or not a lot of history of these types of events occurring within this region.
Do we know what might happen? Could charges be laid against these Papua New Guinean officials?
Well, if the incident occurred within Papua New Guinea waters, the answer to that is most likely no. I think at the most, we would see diplomatic representations made by the Indonesian government to raise their concerns about the death of an Indonesian fisherman. But then subject to how the circumstances unfold, that matter could possibly go even further. But at the moment, I think we're still in the investigative stage.
That was Australian National University maritime law expert, Professor Donald Rothwell. There's still a bit of confusion around Solomon Islands' decision to suspend foreign naval ships from entering its waters. It came after a US vessel was unable to dock because the Solomon Islands government didn't respond to a refueling request, and a British ship was also excluded. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manase Sogavare explained the policy.
Ladies and gentlemen, the delay in these approvals demonstrate the need for my government to review and refine our approval requirements and, of course, the procedures for visiting military vessels to Solomon Islands. And to this end, we have requested our partners to give us time to review and put in place our new processes before sending further requests for military vessels to enter the country. Once the new mechanism is in place, we will inform you all. We anticipate the new process to be smoother and timelier.
Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare there speaking at a welcome ceremony this week for a U.S. hospital ship that was allowed in before the suspension. The moratorium has caused some concern in the region. Here's Papua New Guinea's Foreign Minister Justin Shchenko.
Well, I don't know much about it personally, but that's Solomon Islands' call. They've got to think about these decisions they're making now and think of the repercussions in the future. You know, you keep on pushing away a friendly ally. You know, it's times of need, they might not be there for you. And the situation is that's why being friends to all and enemies to none and working with everybody for the benefit of your people and your country is the right way forward.
That was Papua New Guinea's Foreign Minister Justin Shchenko there with some pointed words about Solomon Islands' decision to put in place a moratorium on foreign naval ships. But how likely is it that an outright ban would be put in place? Reporter Nick Fogarty spoke to Australian National University Research Fellow Dr. Terence Wood to find out.
I, for one, would be really surprised if a full-scale moratorium was slapped on at this point in time. I mean, the US has just re-engaged in Solomon Islands in a more concerted manner. So it obviously would be a potential source of additional aid. It would seem unlikely that the Solomon's government would really want to antagonize the United States at this point in time. On top of that, not as if it's really got anything to hide or that the Chinese have got anything to hide in Solomon Islands at this particular point in time. Indeed, I'd imagine that the Chinese themselves would be surprised to find Solomon Islands antagonizing an old ally right now.
What do you think would be a sensible response from America and indeed other nations who might not be able to bring their naval vessels in to Honiara either?
So my advice to countries like the United States, the United Kingdom and Australia would be to continue the charm offensive for the time being. So I saw that Prime Minister Albanese was talking about bringing Sogavare to Australia and meeting with him personally. And the United States, of course, has increased its presence, its consular presence in Solomon Islands recently. My sense is just thinking about the way that Prime Minister Sogavare responds to perceived intervention from foreign powers and what he would see to be the business of the government of Solomon Islands was that at this point in time, actually just turning on the charm, some demonstrations and friendship, some indication that neither Australia nor the United States really want to steer the affairs of Solomon Islands, you know, in a sort of hands-on kind of way, pandering to the way that Prime Minister Sogavare sees the world would be a wise approach at this point in time.
Australian National University Research Fellow Dr. Terence Wood speaking there to Nick Fogarty. To Fiji, where there are concerns about new amendments to the country's Electoral Act, the changes give a range of additional powers to the Supervisor of Elections. Marion Farr spoke with the President of the Fiji Law Society, Wiley Clark, about what those powers mean and how it could impact citizens.
So the Electoral Amendment Bill proposes to amend the Electoral Act by making some key changes to one of the sections in that act, which spells out what the powers of the Supervisor of Election are. And it starts that by stating in very sort of broad terms that the supervisor has all powers necessary to carry out his or her functions under this act. But then it goes on to say that if the supervisor has any reason to believe that a person has information or documents relevant to or required by the supervisor for the performance of his or her functions under that act, the supervisor can give notice to that person, directing that person to furnish that information or documents to the supervisor. The second part of that is that the person on whom that notice is served must disclose that information or document to the supervisor, and that is notwithstanding any law that provides confidentiality, privilege, or secrecy to that information or document.
And so to kind of break it down in quite simple terms, what I understand is that it means that the supervisor of the elections, who's the person sort of responsible for overseeing the electoral process in Fiji, now has these powers to kind of access information and documents basically with very kind of little restriction upon those powers. Even it kind of overrides other laws that might restrict access to that information otherwise. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So effectively, the supervisor can request those documents under any pretext whatsoever, because there is no real qualifier or threshold which needs to be met before the supervisor can make that demand. What is concerning about this is that I've never actually seen a power as broad as this conferred on one person and a public officer at that.
You've sort of voiced concerns that this proposed amendment attacks Fijian citizens' right to privacy, including legal professional privilege and other types of privacy. I guess, what are the risks there in your view in practical terms?
Well, the risks are that such a broad and unfettered power in the hands of one person, you know, is prone to abuse. And because there is no real supervisory or review body that decides whether the supervisor can exercise that power, because there is nothing like that provided under this bill, there is literally no information or document that the supervisor of elections cannot obtain. And so by doing that, it really does potentially impact private citizens and organizations.
But I wonder how likely that is. I mean, we're talking about sort of private citizens and businesses, but wouldn't it be more likely that these laws would be applied to, say, political candidates or members of political parties or political parties themselves, who probably should be subject to higher levels of scrutiny and accountability?
Well, that scrutiny and accountability is already there. The Electoral Act already provides quite onerous responsibilities and obligations on political parties. And there is also a process there by which, if an offence is suspected of having been committed, that matter is referred to the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption. And they have power under their act to investigate and indeed determine whether an offence has been committed or not. The problem with the bill is that that entire process appears to be circumventable.
Fiji Law Society President Wiley Clark speaking there with Marion Farr. Staying in Fiji, where drug exhibits that could be used in courts as evidence in a case have been going missing from police stations. To crack down on the problem, Fiji police have been burning large quantities of drugs in their possession. Hugo Hodge with this report.
A major police operation is underway in Fiji to destroy more than 12 tons of drugs in police evidence rooms over fears that confiscated drugs are making their way back onto the streets. Commissioner of Police Brigadier General Sitiveni Kilio told the Fiji Broadcasting Corporation in July it was an ongoing problem.
Drug exhibits have gone missing from our exhibit rooms. I admit that, and that's under investigations, and people that are involved in that are taken to court. And there's also a general perception that that continues to happen. No, we've tightened up on that, and that's one of the measures that we've taken, so that we destroy all the drug exhibits, so that officers don't get tempted.
Five police officers were suspended for drug-related offences in August for confiscating and then reselling narcotics back to drug dealers on the island Kandavu. Fiji police acted fast, gaining court approval to destroy 5 tons of marijuana stored as drug exhibits at Kandavu police station. The police commissioner said a handful of rogue police officers were tarnishing the reputation and hard work of thousands of police officers who were committed to fighting the war on drugs. Fiji's Minister for Defence, National Security and Policing, Inya Serawi Ratu, says he wants to get rid of all drug exhibits immediately, but that this was not his decision to make.
Commissioner and government are doing our best to get rid of these rogue elements within the police force. The destruction of the drugs is not the call of the police commissioner. That is a decision that the court decides for the police commissioner. So that's the justice system in play. It's not as simple as it is. Of course, we want to get rid of it immediately because to take away the element of temptation, and of course, we need the spaces as well, and it's becoming a health hazard as well for our people. And we are thankful that now the courts is very facilitative on that. And of course, pending on the investigations as well. So it's a matter of time.
The Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions receives weekly requests from police to destroy drugs that have been confiscated. In August, 126 applications were made by police to destroy 181,000 cannabis plants, weighing close to 12 tonnes. That's up from just 2.5 tonnes of cannabis destroyed in July. Police used incinerators, including one in a crematorium, to turn the drugs to ashes. Senior fellow at the Australian Pacific Security College, Jose Souza Santos, describes the quantity of drugs as industrial scale.
The pandemic has been a boon to criminal organisations who have exploited distracted governments and desperate populations who are under economic duress.
He says Fiji is caught in the network of global criminal syndicates in Asia, Mexico and South America.
We're starting to see hybrid regional criminal gangs engaging with these transnational criminal syndicates and facilitating the movement of the drugs through the Pacific towards the Australian and New Zealand markets.
Psychologist Selena Kuruletha thinks the incineration of drugs is designed to send a smoke signal to the local community more than anything.
From where I stand and my work in the community, it's very clear that there's a lot of very disillusioned people. The people are disillusioned in the sense that the general community and the perception of the Fiji Police Force is quite negative right now.
Miss Kuruletha runs her own consulting firm and works with young people affected by drugs. She questions the timing of the drug burning.
So I think people are looking right through that. Why do we have to wait till a crime is committed by the police officers and then go and destroy the drugs? I want to think it's isolated. I want to think that, but I know it's not isolated. This has been going on for a while. Just these group were caught red-handed.
But Mr. Souza Santos believes Fiji police are stamping out internal corruption. And he says by burning the marijuana, it sends a dual message.
One is to the perpetrators, to the drug smugglers and to the growers of cannabis. I think the other is to the Fijian public, which is also to ease the fears that the Fijian police is completely losing control of what's happening internally.
While the recent publicity may be on marijuana, there are fears that there is a bigger danger in the country.
We're seeing the rise of methamphetamine usage in schools, in high schools.
There's a lot of synthetic drugs here. I think marijuana in Fiji is the least of our worries. We should be worried about the synthetic drugs.
Traffickers and drug dealers can make anywhere between $2,500 to $5,000 US dollars a day selling methamphetamines in the domestic market.
People are desperate. This is why they're trying to figure out a way to make a quick buck. People are desperate. They're trying to find a way to relieve some of this stress. Stress of unemployment, stress of reduced working hours, stress of the high cost of living.
With little to no drug rehabilitation programs in Fiji, Ms. Kuruletha worries the nation's methamphetamine problem will soon get out of hand.
We just need to change our whole approach to this. And the Fiji police has started somewhat, but then we keep coming back to this marijuana.
That was psychologist Selena Kuruletha, ending that report by Hugo Hodge. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. Thanks for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.